Okay, we're going to start tonight with the Ron. The Ron, he's the guy in the back of the Gemara. I hope we're aware of that. That sounds like we are. I hope even Shana Aleph guys are aware of that.
Guy.
The Ron's name was Rabbeinu Nissim ben Reuven. He lived most of his life in Barcelona. 1290 to 1375. He was also a doctor. The Ron. Rabbeinu Nissim, the one in the back of the Gemara. What? Say again? Reuven. Rabbeinu Nissim ben Reuven. Ron Bar. He's called the Ron. Some we show, some late we show him, early Akronim call him the Ron Bar. As opposed to Rabbeinu Nissim Gon. Rabbeinu Nissim Gon was one of the Gonim. I don't think I'm bothered mentioning him. He lived about 400 years before this.
What's his years? 1290 to 1375.
He learned by his father, who was a Talmud of the Rajba. Now, we could prove that he obviously wasn't born in Barcelona. We don't know where he was born, but he wasn't born in Barcelona, and he must have lived in a different part, quite different part of Spain, because the Rajba died in 1310. And the Ron was 20 years old when the Rajba died, and you definitely can learn by somebody when, you know, people were intellectually mature at around the age 15 or so. You can certainly learn by somebody if they're, you know, you're 15 and they're 70 years old, that's fine. And clearly the Ron was not born in Barcelona. He was a Talmud of his father, who was a Talmud of the Rajba. Now, my opinion, personally, is the Ron is the end of the quotes, what I call real Rishonim. Yeah. So you want to know, why do I consider the Ron the end of the real Rishonim? I'll explain myself. There's two things. There's how we look at them, and then how they looked at themselves. And in terms of how we look at people, we definitely extend the Rishonim later. We consider people who we're going to, I hope we'll get to tonight, the Maharil, the Truma Sadashin, the Muki Yosef. We consider all these people Rishonim. But they didn't consider themselves Rishonim. In other words, if you learn the Ron consistently, you'll see the Ron will argue with anybody. He will argue with Rashi. He will argue with Tosfos. He will argue with the Rambam. That's what the Ron's going to do. The Ron, Ki'ilo, you know, clearly considered himself to be on the same level. And he didn't have a problem arguing. He will bring proof. He's not going to argue with Rashi, just Rashi says it. He's not going to just bring proof. He's not going to do what Tosfos will just say, ain't no nearer to Rashi. He won't even bother substantiate. Sometimes Tosfos will substantiate the Kasha. A lot of times he'll just say, ain't no nearer. No. This is better. Better idea. So the Ron's going to substantiate more what he says, but the Ron will argue with the Rishonim. And does it many times. And come up with his own very, you know, his own mechudosh, his own chidushim, consistently. And the Ron does it not once, he does it with Rishas. And that's what the Ron does. So the fact that he does that shows you he's in the same league. Ki'ilu, if you understand what I mean. Yeah.
How do we differentiate?
So in other words, here's how I say it. I mean, the classic people classically say approximately Gerush Sfard, expulsion from Spain, 1492, 1500. That's when most people put the line. I say really the Ron is the real line. In other words, after the Ron, they're closer to Rishonim than Acharonim, and we view their decisions definitely, you know, even the early Acharonim, Dehainu Maharshal, we'll speak about these people later. Maharshal, you know, the Nosei Kelim, Magen Avraham, Taz, Sma, etc. Beis Yosef, even, they're going to view the people a little bit after the Ron, still as Rishonim.
What did Maharshal mean?
The Maharshal is even later. The Maharshal is around 1580 to 1640. Yeah, maybe it's 1570 to 1630. The Maharshal is, yeah.
I remember learning that we value that the distinction between the two is because there's a change in like data. It went from identifying like different sources like data collection, like Shulchan Aruch or...
I don't know if I agree with that. I don't know if I can, because you see already. First of all, the Rambam is like independent. You know, I don't know if I agree with that. I think the better way to substantiate it is.
So the way of learning rather is different because of the fact that they learned light meaning.
Well, again, no, but that's what I said. In other words, that's what I said. You're right. In other words, the Ran, I certainly learned Rashi and Tosis, but the Ran considered himself an independent, you know, objective. He considered himself an authority on Shas, equal to Tosis. Not mamish equal. He knew Tosis was bigger than him, but he considered himself able to argue with Tosis directly. And you're right. That's why I'll show you the Maribe Rav the Maribe Rav is the Beis Yosef, the Rebbe of the Beis Yosef's Rebbe. He's two doors before the Beis Yosef. Died in the early 1500s. If you look at his parish on Kedushin, anyone? No? Okay. If you learn Kedushin seriously, so the Maribe Rav is printed, and you'll see the Maribe Rav is very similar to the Marsha. That means he's an Akron. He's not a Rishon. He's not doing what a Rishon does. He's doing what an Akron does. It's definitely true that even the Marshal Beis Yosef, and certainly later, you know, Magen Avraham, Shachtaz, etc., are going to view the 130 years after this. They're going to say those are people we can't argue on directly. But still, after the Ran, basically after the Ran, you don't have people didn't the Talmidei Chacham at that time didn't consider themselves authoritative and substantial enough to directly be Mefarash Shas and directly, you know, go head to head with people before them. This might look, you know, Josh, I've been like bothered by this problem for 25 years. Like, how do you define it? But I'm not just doing it in a historical method. I've also been involved in learning. So this is my personal observations on how I think it should be divided. And I take, you know, I can't take credit. Either I'm right or I'm wrong. There's no way to prove one way or the other. I mean, again, you could basically, there's different levels in Achronim, you understand. There's Achronim, let's say, up to around 1700 and post-1700. And post-1700 Achronim, I mean, that gets more complicated. We're not going to get there for it. See, the Shai Gezari would argue with more or less anybody else. You know, he'd argue with the Rambam also. But that's an exception to the rule. That's not the rule. Shai Gezari, I mean, I can't resist telling you this story. You know the famous legend of the Shai Gezari?
Clearly not.
Okay. The famous legend of the Shai Gezari. Shai Gezari argued with everybody outside. He didn't argue with Rashi. And usually doesn't. And Tosus, not so much, but occasionally. So legend has it, he died in his mid-90s. The way he died was a shelf of the Rishonim came and fell on him and fatally injured him. And as he was dying, he was misvada. He said, it's probably because I wasn't careful enough in their honor. That's why they all fell on me and killed me. That's the famous legend of the Shai Gezari. I have no idea if there's any substance to this legend, but that's the famous legend of the Shai Gezari. Say again?
And it was like a specific reason.
I'm not sure. That much I'm not sure. I didn't hear it that way. And to substantiate a legend like this is not going to be... It shouldn't be that hard. You know what? The Shai Gezari died a little over 200 years ago. The problem is his last tenure in the rabbinate was in Mainz. Mainz is in Germany. And it wasn't... And we don't have... There's a certain, you know, break in the Masorah from what is going on in Germany. In other words, we have a relatively clear Masorah from dating certainly till the Vilna Gaon, and even things a little before that. I'm just going from legend to legend. The legend has it like this. I'll give you an example of something 350 years old, which is a legend. It's Polish Jewish legend. The Taz was married to the Shah, to the Bach's daughter.
Okay.
The Taz was married to the Bach's daughter.
It's not legend.
Yeah. No, that's not. We'll get to the legend. Now, the rule in Shulchan Aruch in learning in Halacha Be'ilin is, as the Taz thinks, is Shver is Shver. The Shver, that's for a father-in-law, is Shver. That's like the rule. He's even when he doesn't explicitly say he's arguing with Mori V'chami, my Shver is Shver, he's usually arguing with him anyway. And one of the classics when he's you know attacking the Levush, he attacks the Levush saying, "Vafil Mori V'chami even came. Even my Shver got this one right." Anyway, the Jewish legend, that's true. That I've seen. Now the legend is when the Bach's daughter died, the Taz gave a very eloquent eulogy. And a little afterwards, he went to the Bach and asked him for his next daughter. So the Bach said back to him, "No way! Your Ashes, the wife of your youth, dies, and you're so eloquent? You should be emotionally broken! I'm not giving you another one of my daughters." Okay, that's a legend. That's a legend we have of the Bach. Of the Bach and the Taz. So that we don't have, you know, things like this, we don't have, it should exist about the Shagas Aryeh, but because of Haskalah, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't exist that I know of. Okay, fine. Let's get back. I couldn't resist that. That was like tangents on tangents there. Okay. Okay. As we know, the Ran wrote Kiddushim. Maybe you guys don't realize this. The Ran, there's two different things the Ran did. One are Chidushim on Shas. That is Chidushim authored directly on the Gemaras. That's one thing the Ran did. The other thing the Ran did was write on the Rif. Now, the Ran on the Rif is technically a Perush on the Rif, but the Ran wrote it, so a lot of it does have to do with the Sugyas. But he does get back, he always does get around to telling you what the Rif's going to do, but the Ran on the Rif is sort of a Perush on the Rif. I mean, it's not a parish on the Rif the way Rashi is a parish on Shas. You understand? It's more the Ran was a tremendous. The Ran's an unbelievable Machadish. It's like unbelievable. You know, I keep me'ain. This is chutzpah, but I'll be about chutzpah sometimes. The Ran's chidushim are like so, like phew, something else. You sort of feel like you know they said that Rabbeinu Haigun was so big. Everyone knew that the tikkuf of the Gaonim was over. And that's what I sort of say about them. The Ran's condition, like they rate with the Rajman and the Ritva without a problem. He feels like an absolute equal Rajman to Ramban, and they're like well before him, 50 years before him, clearly. I mean, the Rajman is really closer to 60, 70 years before him, and the Ramban's 100 years before him. And he feels like you know when you see the Kiddushim and you feel them out, they feel like they're more or less the same thing. So I don't know. That's my opinion. Okay, Vaitra. Now the people, I believe the Shema, the Chida, and others point out that the Ran never quotes the Rush. The Ran never quotes the Rush, which is Mechudesh. It's interesting. Why is that so interesting? Because the Ran, the Rush, we know died in Iran, I think it was 1330, 1327. And he definitely wrote his Perush, his Piskei Arush, after he moved to Spain. And that was in the 1310s, 1320s. And one would think that the Ran would have had it by the time he wrote his stuff on the Rif and the Chidushim, but he never quotes, I mean, I'm not a big enough bucket to say this, but the Achronim who were say he never quotes the Rush. So obviously he didn't have it. Because it's inconceivable that if he had it, he wouldn't bother quoting it. Okay. The Ran also wrote Drushas, the famous Drushas Aran. I love the Drushas Aran. It's such a great, it's mamish, beautiful. It's one of the, it's a real bridge, the Drushas Aran. We have the Rambam and the Ramban. The Rambam and the Ramban talking about philosophy, Machshava, key issues in Agadata. And the Ran is like coming to address most of those issues. There's so many key Rans that it's like hard to. I don't even think I'm going to say anything over because we don't really get too bogged down and there's a lot to do. And I was still didn't give up hope on getting to Shabtai Tzvi by the end of the year and saying something about it. So therefore, I'm not going to diverge more. I'm simply going to tell you that the Ran on Drushes is very, very, very key. I personally feel, see, the Ran's not a Mokobel, and I don't remember what my proofs to that were, because I'm not holding in the sefer right now, but the Ran's clearly not a Mokobel. However, the other side of the story is on a lot of the key controversial topics, the Ran takes a clear side, and I personally found it a tremendous, you know, like Yila Deus Shlishis, a third important opinion. Like you have the Rambam, you have the Ramban, Rashi, you have the Ran coming to put out his opinion on what like the mainline approach should be to a lot of major topics. Now, interesting thing that I didn't note and I didn't have time to look up, but the Ran does make a veiled reference to the Black Plague, which was in 1348, 1349, as we may be aware. It's fascinating, as I recall the reference, which I didn't have time to look up, is the Ran comments that before this happened, people had normal lifespans, and afterwards, people's lifespans were shortened significantly. So that's like an interesting historical fact to throw out for, you know, like... I don't remember. It's in one of the later drushes. I can't remember why, but he clearly anyone who knows that the Black Plague happened during the Ran's life could figure out that that's what he's talking about. I mean, whatever. Yeah.
What's drushes
of Ran about? Each one has its topic. So you want me to start spewing out how the Ran talks about machlokas, origin of machlokas. Wow, that's such a good piece. He's like, there's the Rambam, the main one, and there's sources early Rishonim that definitely learned like the Ran. There's a Ritva, there's a Tosfos Rosh, but they don't really, you know, you have to use a lot of imagination, which is probably fun, but we don't know how accurate our imaginations are, and the Ran clearly goes through the Sugya and shows you a different approach than the Rambam. Mazel, Kol Chatzibur. Now, in Vime, I'm going to torture. I'm going to torture you guys right now. So, the torture, I'm going to tell you the most famous piece in the Drushes of Ran is what I call the Ran's residual, a theory of residual Kedusha. Did we talk about that last year? No. That's the Ran's theory of residual Kedusha. And there's not time to go through it now. Ha, ha, ha. I can't explain it right now. That means
leftover.
Now, I can't explain it to you now because it will take, to do it right, take to do it in a minimalistic fashion is a 10-minute divergence, and we must go on. Isn't that torture? But I actually said shir on it last night. Yeah. And if you want, you can listen. I've said Sharon a couple of times. I'm happy over dinner to explain it to whoever wants to hear the Ran's theory of residual Kedusha. You know, he connects it to that also. Then he goes through everything. He argues with the Ramban about Malchus Beis David. He's Mechadish. He's Kedusha. All of it's unbelievable. The Drushes Haran is it's an unbelievable Hebrew. I believe that Rabbi Lichtenstein said Machshav Shirim on it a number of years ago. Okay. 1390, let's go on. 1391 is one of the most important critical periods in Spain. There was the King of Castile, whose name in English is rendered into John, but in Spanish would be Juan. Juan or Juan. Okay? He died. He left over his 12-year-old son, who's called in English Henry, but in Spanish is called, anyone knows?
Enrique.
What?
Enrique.
Enrique. Very good. There you go, John. Very good. Enrique. Now, we know that anyone who's sort of familiar with general history is aware that whenever there's a minor in a regency, that's usually not, that usually leads to anarchy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's not a good situation, okay? It's rare that there are rare cases where regencies turned out okay. Shlomo apparently seems to have, even though he was only 12, he was of mature intellect and ruled on his own from the first day. And if you want another thing that I could tell you, an unbelievable midrash about the famous story of the two ladies, but not now. That would take also like 5-7 minutes, and I just too much to do.
You're promising yourself a lot.
I'm like putting out real torture here tonight. Am I not?
Okay. You're just making yourself like you realize you're gonna have to give like another share during dinner about all this stuff.
Yeah, the sword and the baby. Yeah, that famous story. I could tell you something really very interesting Midrash about it. Okay. Anyway, so Juan the First dies, and Enrique the Third takes over, and the normal state of anarchy breaks out, and unfortunately, due to there was a specific Catholic, priest and a minister who was preaching anti-Jewish stuff for years beforehand.
Shocking.
Yeah, and his name I didn't bother writing down because I didn't feel he deserved to be mentioned. Anyway, people do say that he was like stirring up the masses. And previously, when the king was king of control, he didn't want the Jews to be killed because of economic loss. But once there was no one really in control, major riots broke out. Now, they did not only affect Castile, which was the main part of Spain. I need to bring a proper map in to show you what Castile and Aragon look like. But anyway, they spread to the rest of Spain, which means Aragon, Valencia, and there were massive anti-Jewish riots for at least 6 months, if not closer to a year, 1391. Massive Jewish riots. It's practically speaking, it's not mamish the end, but it's definitely the beginning of the end. Now, there are two things that happened in the riots and one thing that happened after the riots. The two things that happened in the riots are forced baptism. Yeah, which means they would drag people to a pool of water, force them in, and say, "You are Christian now. Tough luck. And if you would revert to practicing Judaism, you are therefore a heretic and you can be killed."
Were they converted back to Judaism?
Ke'ilu, that's right. Ke'ilu. That forced baptism is very, there's forced baptism, and then there is one step, slightly better, which is, okay, I'm going to kill you. Do you want to baptize? You could baptize or get killed. So this happened in a significant amount at this period of time in these riots. Both types of forced baptisms and baptisms under duress, and the church went back and forth about forced baptism and whether it's chal, whether it has legal effect or not. They ended up saying it does. Later on, after Reformation and Enlightenment, so then they changed their minds. But that was too late for the too late for the people they killed earlier. Yeah. We're gonna get there, Josh. We're almost there. Okay. Now, afterwards, what they did after that was they initiated a lot of public pressure. And previously in Spain, Jews had a lot more opportunities for what they're allowed to do. They were, I wouldn't say completely unrestricted, but largely unrestricted. They started restricting what Jews were allowed to do. Engaged in a lot of pressure to try to force Jews to convert. Not mamish like the sword, but a lot of pressure was put on, economic pressure, forced debates, forcing Jews to listen to priests preach in shul, in synagogues. This went on for a long time. The most famous of the debates was in Tortosa. Went on for 2.5 years, from 1413 to 1415.
Now, what are you talking about?
1400 is boring,
so they said. Tortosa?
Yeah,
1413 to 1415. Now, the problem of the forced baptisms and baptisms under duress, as I unfortunately was not able to re-find this. I know where the book is in my. I think I know where the book is in my house, but it's like the book is rambling. It's like written by a very professional historian on one hand. On the other hand, I found it to be rambling. And I enjoy history books normally. So anyway, the kids are, as one historian puts it, you know, these Jews who were forced to convert to Christianity or converted under duress and obviously weren't that interested in it, there was a major problem. And the problem was after they converted, they went back to living in their same exact house with all their Jewish neighbors who they were related to, a lot of them also. So that wasn't, you know, that created, this like created, this is the beginning of the Murano problem. And the reason why it was such a problem, at least in Spain, amongst Spanish Jewry, the mainline approach is that the Murano problem went on for about 150 years. Now, the longer term Murano problem, which we're going to get to later on, is really Portuguese Muranos. And we'll speak about that later. I'm not sure exactly when, because I hope we'll be able to do this next week. If we're able to do that, then hopefully we'll get to it in another two or three classes. But okay, approximately two or three classes. I think that's what it feels like to me. Okay. Anyway, now I also noted in a number of sources, and these were like general works, claiming that. Is possibly up to a third, maybe even 40% of Spanish Jewry converted in the between 1390 and approximately 1420. I personally find that difficult to believe. And the reason why I find it difficult to believe, first of all, you have to understand, and this is very, very important to understand, that statistics in early modern world, even though there is something there, there definitely is something there. In other words, it's not like, let's say, before, in most places, 1300, you practically don't know what was going on. That's like slight exaggeration, but in terms of real numbers, censuses, England is an exception to the rule. In England's an exception to the rule, and you more or less know what's going on from, let's say, 1150. More or less. And more than less. And the later you get, it's a lot more than a lot less. But English Jewry, as historians point out, it's not that important. But it's very well documented. Very, very well documented. So in late medieval, early modern Europe, people, I'll just give you like an example, a historical example. Historians used to think, and it was definitely popular legend, that between 50% to two-thirds of Germans died in the 30 Years' War. Now, the 30 Years' War, we know when that was? You want to know the 30 Years' War for us? Okay, 1618 to 1648. Okay, that's the 30 Years' War. Okay, that is early modern history. There are relatively good historical sources for us to use to look back and try to quantify it. Historians carefully today, in the last 30 years, 40 years, carefully looking at censuses and tax records throughout all of Germany, they're still not sure because it wasn't done really professionally. It wasn't done like modern post-1840 professionally, where we basically, the census of the United States has basically been done professionally the entire time, people who want to cooperate, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That didn't exist in the 1500s. People were trying not to be on the tax rolls. If you were listed, that means you had to pay. And you don't have to be Jewish to figure out that it's better not to be listed. Okay? So modern historians using a lot of research will tell you that it's probably between 20 and 30% of Germany died. Now, it's true. There are places where it went up to 95%. Where almost everyone was killed. But it's also true that there are places like Hamburg which grew during the 30 Years' War. So If we take Germany as a sum total, I'm just giving this as a, you know, like as an example to say why, like, the, first of all, the numbers, like, I don't know, who knows how many Jews really lived in Spain? Who knows? 300,000? Maybe, could be, I don't know, who knows? I'm not sure that number, maybe another estimation also, maybe not. But to say that between 100 and 150,000 are converted, I don't think so. Not, the real reason I don't think so is I have gone through the Ksavim of the Chassid Yavetz, Rabbi Yosef Yavetz. He was from Mugurasha, people who had to leave Spain. He lived from 14, I wrote it down here, from 1435 to 1517. And when he writes about the expulsion, a significant amount of people staying behind, and no one says it was half who stayed behind for the records. It wasn't half. It was at most a third. The biggest estimate is a third stayed behind. And he writes about that like, this is a tragedy unparalleled in Jewish history. Now, you understand, it's if the same thing had happened not long before he had lived, the basic nature of history and folk history in, you know, that time was things weren't forgotten so quickly. It's not like today that, you know, that Watergate is ancient history. And Vietnam is like what? And Korea? When the Korean conflict happened? Like, you understand? First World War. Whoa, man, that's a long time ago. That's not how people looked at things once upon a time. Not pre-First World War, the world moved a lot slower. And pre-Napoleonic War, it moved even immensely slower. So, it's not. Look, I'll give you an example. Von Bülow was one of the chancellors of Germany. He ruled Germany basically from around 1900 to 1909. Okay, he's probably he loved power but didn't know what to do with it. His ineptitude and lack of foresight in foreign policy. If you really want to know who to blame for the First World War, he's one of the people you can blame. Okay, anyway, Von Bülow says, the French are cruel, military, aggressive people, not like the peace-loving, naive Germans. Okay, I'm glad I got you guys good. That's excellent. Now, why did he say that? Because you're saying crazy, but you have to understand from 1670, from Louis XIV when he started really ruling, 1660 or so, all the way through Napoleon, the French just walked into Germany every couple of years and did whatever they wanted. Okay? So it's been 100 years. It's been 100 years practically since the French really since the French threatened Germany. But again, the point is the cultural history is there. So it, to say that there was such a major amount, you know, 25-30%, 30-50% conversions between 1390 and 1420, and the Chassid Yavetz is like getting all upset about 25% later. I can't. That just happened. I mean, what's your problem? That would seem to me to say that it was a lower percentage, even though it's, of course, again, it's going to be very difficult to really substantiate these things in a real way. The tone, it's not once, he over and over, it's like, it's such a live tragedy, and if such a thing had happened not that long earlier, he wouldn't have. It's like, look, I'll give you a Jewish historical example. You ever heard of the Frankists? No?
Yes.
Jacob Frank, Yaakov Frank. Okay. No one's shocked by the Frankists because that's just the fallout of Shabtai Tzvi. You're not shocked by Yaakov Frank because it's a fallout of the Dunman, Yaakov, and then Shatz. Shabtai Tzvi. So it's not like Frank is 80, 90 years afterwards. 70, so let's say about 70 years, 60, 70. It's significant. So it's the same. It wasn't forgotten. Things like this are not forgotten. Today we forget things that happened 70 years ago. But then in the old days they didn't forget things so quickly. Okay. Now there is a basic point which everyone mentions, so I think I should mention also. There's no question that Spanish Jewry did not react the way that Ashkenazi Jewry reacted to the First Crusades, etc., etc. First Crusades expulsions to Ashkenazi Jewry from, you know, from 1096 to the First Crusade, up through all the expulsions. The Jews in Germany and France could have converted, but as a rule, they didn't. It's more than a rule. It's, I mean, there were definitely rare conversions, but they were rare. It's sort of like conversions in Jewish Poland in the 1800s. They happened. I'd say they didn't happen, but you're talking about a fraction of a percent. So the question, people were bothered. They were bothered then, and historians are bothered now. And the honest truth is, no one has anything to say that hasn't been already said, and that is that even though it should have been made clear from, you know, the Rambam and those who did engage in philosophy, that philosophy is not meant to be a mass movement. Nonetheless, it was. And if a person is not, and the Rambam himself is very clear about this, if a person is not very strongly based in Torah, then if you engage in philosophy, that will weaken your, you know, connection to Torah. And that's that. No one really. That is the probable reason why. That's what the early Achronim, late Rishonim, early Achronim said about it. And no one really has anything much more to say about it today either. So that's most probably why such a thing happened. Again, what the exact numbers were, I'm very interested, of course, in seeing someone do and reading, you know, proper study of it. It would be very interesting to see. That carefully, you know, uses all known, as many known sources as a person knows, and that'd be interesting to see such a thing. Okay, fine. Rabbeinu Chasdai Kreskes lived 30s. What?
How do you spell that?
Yeah, well, Chasdai, I figure you get Kreskes is your problem. Right. In Hebrew, it's written for some reason. Skas. Those are sins, not shins. It should be really written like this. That's how it should be really written. People, for some reason, like to call him Krash Krash. That's wrong. Yeah.
What?
Yeah, it's really a psalm. It's really a sin. So it's Kreskes. It's Kreskes. Rabbeinu Chasdai Kreskes. He's most famous for writing his sefer called Or Hashem. People call it, quotes, anti-philosophy philosophy. I personally tried to learn it. I was interested to see what it was. That's how I was able to see that I'm not a real philosopher. The reason why is he is, to say intense is not even strong enough, practically obsessed, ki'ilu, with the question of, does real infinity exist?
True infinity.
Oh, it's a key. It's like, I understand conceptually why it's an important idea, but to go through 80 pages of proof, counterproof, counter-counterproof, counter-counter-counterproof, back, forth, back. I just was like, I skipped that part.
And when,
what? I don't remember. I think there has to be true infinity, because I'm actually not sure. I don't know. You're asking me? I don't know. Anyway, Bekitzer, the rest of the Sefer talks about Ikrin, and because the beginning of it is so intense, it was really not that popular of a Sefer. It was never that popular.
The what?
Popular of a Sefer.
Of a Sefer.
He is important. I found, one of the things I found, I mean, he goes through the Ikrim, and I don't think it's a coincidence at all that the Ikrim are being worked on in this period. Now, this is a period of time when Ikrei Yahadus, the main tenets of the Jewish religion, are being challenged by Christianity. What? His dates are 1340 to 1415. Because the
1415.
Because you know, the Ikrim, the main tenets of Judaism, are being challenged. That's why there's his sefer. And, you know, I'm going to go slightly out of order. His Talmud's name was Rabbi Yosef Albo, 1380 to 1440. Yosef Albo wrote a sefer called Sefer HaIkrim. And that is a popular sefer. That's a popular sefer, unlike the Or Hashem, which is similar to the Drasha Saran, which means it's academic. And it's like a fascinating thing. I don't know if you've ever tried to read anything in quotes modern academic Hebrew. But it has a certain stilted flavor to it, at least in my opinion. It doesn't have the flow, it doesn't have that like pure simplistic flow that the Rishonim usually use. So the Ran uses it in the Drashas, or Rabbeinu Chasdai uses it in the Or Hashem, but Rabbi Yosef Albo in the Ikrim, not only is not obsessed with infinity and true infinity, he also writes in a more classic rabbinic Hebrew, and a very popular sefer, and it's considered like the main counterbalance to the Rambam. In other words, we have the Rambam and Yud Gimel Ikrim, which the Rambam talks about in the Hakdamah Techelik, and also talks about in Yad, and he also talks about some in the Mornevuchim, and the counterbalance to the Rambam is the Ikrim, Sefer Ikrim. He's like the counterbalance. Okay, he actually participated in that big debate in Tortosa. The Rabbi Yosef Alba, the author of the Ikrim, participated in that. That is something he did. Okay. Let's go on to the Namuki Yosef. The Namuki Yosef's exact dates are not really 100% clear. He probably lived around the same time as Rabbeinu Chasdai Kreskes, which means the late 1300s to possibly the early 1400s, but we're not 100% sure. We're not even sure who he learned by. We know he's in the back of the Gemara. What is the Namuki Yosef to? The Namuki Yosef wrote originally on Masechtos that the Ran didn't write on, or that he didn't have the Ran on, and that's what's important about it, that you need something, ki'ilu, you need a parish on the Rif, ki'ilu, where there's no Ran. The Namuki Yosef, in fact, is very heavily influenced by the Ritva, specifically. One assumes he most likely could not have learnt by the Ritva, who died in around 1330, and because we're pretty sure that the Namuki Yosef died around at earliest 1400, it's more or less impossible, and he wasn't a 90-year-old man either when he died, it's more or less impossible to say that he learned by the Ritva, but he apparently learned by one of the Talmidim of the Ritva, apparently. As I told you, the Ran's an independent gun. And if he doesn't like what the early Rishonim said, he's going to just go out on his own and, here I go, guys. The Namuki Yosef is not going to do that. The Namuki Yosef is basing himself primarily on earlier sources. Not that there's no Chiddush there at all. There is some Chiddush. But to go head-to-head with Rashi or Tosfos and the Rambam, or even the Rajba, the Namuki Yosef is not going to do that. He's going to adapt. He's more of an adapter than a Mechadash. Okay. Yeah, let's do one more piece, guys. We're getting a lot done. I'm really happy. Okay, back to Ashkenazi Jewry. Okay, as we already mentioned, Jews were in and out of France. Final expulsion was 1394. Germany, as has been mentioned, and most of us are familiar, was technically unified, but in fact, the Holy Roman Empire was not really an empire. I mean, okay, it's a lot more.
It wasn't Roman,
and it wasn't an empire. Okay.
Whatever.
The reason why Ki'ilu was holy was Ki'ilu, if you think the Pope was holy, I said if you think the Pope was holy, then he was supposed to crown the emperor as emperor, as Kaiser. And that Ki'ilu invested the ruler of the Holy Roman Empire with a claim to legitimacy that no one else had. Because no one else was crowned by the Pope. Okay, anyway. Now, as we may know, even though in the early Holy Roman Empire, it was not an elective office, but by the time we're getting around to things, I'm pretty sure after the Hohenstaufens, it became an elective office. I'm not even sure. I was not able to check and see if the Hohenstaufens were elected or not elected, but certainly post-Hohenstaufens, Frederick Barbarossa, Barbarossa. Frederick Barbarossa. You heard of Barbarossa? Frederick Barbarossa. The Hohenzollerns were the kings of Prussia, and they're much later. We're not getting into the Hohenstaufens. The Hohenstaufens. I was not able to figure out if the Hohenstaufens were elected or inherited. I don't even want to talk about them because it's like nothing to do with Jewish history. But post Hohenstaufens, which is the period we're in, it was an elective office. There were three. What do they call them? I can't think of the right word for this one. I don't think it's clerical, but maybe it's three clerical electors: elector of Mainz, elector of Cologne, and I can't remember the third one right now. And then there were also four temporal electors. They were the people who elected the Holy Roman Emperor.
The elector of the Palatinate?
The Palatinate was temporal. The first ones, the reason they're getting mentioned in Jewish history classes, they were all archbishops. And one of the great ironies of Jewish history is even though the Germans, the temporal Germans, the secular Germans, learned from the French and bothered and threw Jews out here, there, the next, all over the place, there was no unified policy because Germany wasn't unified. And basically, definitely, basically, with almost without exception, the archbishops never threw the Jews out. That's like the irony of Jewish history. That, you know, the archbishops, the ecclesiastic states, which were relatively large for the records, almost never threw Jews out. So that's what the Jews in Germany in this period were, and there's not that much. The creative period is basically not really that going on that much, and we're going to get on to specifics next, some of the specifics next week. But just one last point: this is when Jews start moving into Poland. This is when Jews start moving to Bohemia. Bohemia is modern day Czech Republic. Bohemia, Moravia. What? This is the 1300s, the mid-12s, from let's say 1230 to 1350, is when Jews start moving east. They start moving into Bohemia, Hungary, and later in the mid-1300s are starting to move into Poland. But, okay, guys.